Captain Waters said, I read all your reports, and obviously you only knew a small part of this picture, and I pieced it all together. Anyway, he brought me the draft of this book, which was called Bloody Winter, not unlike in title Hal Lawrence's book, Bloody War, but certainly that winter of late 1942, early 43 was a bloody winter.
Put it on the tape, the publisher, were you in the
year? Yes, it's Bloody Winter by Captain John M. Waters, Jr., United States Coast Guard, and the publisher is an American publisher, Van Nostrand, N-O-S-T-R-A-N-D. And this book came out somewhere about 1967. Yeah. Well, Captain Waters showed me the draft of this. He said, you may be interested, the fact that I have pieced all the bits together of all the different four nations involved. Well, what transpired out of Captain Waters' analysis of all of this information was that he could not see why the whole convoy wasn't absolutely decimated, that the Germans thought indeed that we had a super radar set that every time they put up a periscope, a destroyer, the rest of us was chasing them and dropping depth charges. So that made them frightened and scared off a lot of the attacks of these U-boats. I think there were only about five of them of the whole group that were 19 that were tagging us that were actually involved in the attacks. And so we were fairly successful in that way. And from the German point of view, they were amazed at the defense that we provided for this convoy. Another thing I found out in this book, that on three occasions, U-boats fired torpedoes at my ship, the good old Restigouche. And on all three occasions, good old the Lucky Who, we were zigging when the torpedoes were zagging, and we missed them, and we knew not that... We didn't even know that of course we anticipated that with all the snowflakes being fired and all the U-boats around, that somebody would take a wing at us, but we never knew at the time that an attack actually had taken place, and there were three such attacks on the Restigouche. Another thing, one of my real suspicions, a minor one at the time, was confirmed, and that is the ship that kept the red light on when that big explosion took place. That was cleared up a week or so later when the next convoy coming along roughly in the same area, I don't know which way it was going, east or west, they suddenly came upon this merchant ship floating straight and upright and proud in the middle of the Atlantic with nobody on board. And they had already picked up some survivors from another convoy, maybe perhaps from my own SC-107, and had put this crew on board this ship and steamed it into the UK with all its stores and everything else intact. And it was a Greek ship, and two lifeboats had departed from the ship, and sad to relate, those two lifeboats never made it to shore, and the whole of the crew of that ship were lost, although the ship was got in. So I'd hardly begun to digest what Captain Waters had written about that convoy when I got a letter from the naval historian in Ottawa to say that Dr. Rover, the German naval historian, who is very well known now in Canada, that he was doing a study of SC-107, and he had written it in German, it had been translated in Ottawa, and would I care to comment on it? And here we are, 22 years after the event. Well, I had my reports and records and very strong memories of this event, of course, and Dr. Rover's book also confirmed with details of names of the U-boat skippers and each one of when he attacked and which one fired torpedoes at me, how they were always put off by the fact that every time they put a periscope up, the Restigouche was chasing them, and the Germans couldn't understand why they hadn't absolutely decimated this convoy completely, with all the escorts and the ships, and that the escort commander had done a hell of a good job. So there we are, 20 or 25 years later, feeling a little happier that one had done not too badly in this whole rather sad circumstance. Well, I went on one more after that.
In another navy, you would have got an Iron Cross.
when that was over, in early November, I took another convoy across, right through the worst of everything, back to Newfoundland, delivered it safely without the loss of a ship, went in for a few days, picked up another one, brought it back to England, and that left me back in England, or back in the UK, for Christmas, the end of 1942.
42.
This is December 42. On this occasion, we went down. I think we had to do a docking to get some repairs, and we were sent to Belfast, which is just down around the corner from London.
Excuse me, I'm being dense. Weren't we not up to the spring of 43 a little while ago?
We were, but...
This is back again.
I have to go back to SC-107.
That's great. Fine.
Yeah, thank you. Restigouche was sent to Belfast to go into dry dock, and I immediately went to call on the Admiral Sir Richard Bevan, who was a most understanding gentleman, a very fine guy. His mother had been born in Halifax, Nova Scotia. We had an immediate rapport, and he became a friend of mine for life. He later, after he retired from the Navy a second time, became one of the chief scouts of the Boy Scout movement in the UK, and he came to Canada and knew all the people like Dan Spry and others who were involved in scouting. But he was a very nice guy and very helpful, and for a Canadian crew, being alone for Christmas abroad, he did everything he could. Now, Christmas is always fun in the Navy, especially when you're away. And you know the old naval custom that on Christmas Day, the youngest ordinary seaman on board the ship becomes captain for the day, as it were, and the captain gets him dressed up in one of his uniforms, and this young man goes around and he goes to all the different messes with the petty officers and the chiefs, and as he's acting captain of the day, he can order the chiefs to do this and do that, and it leads to a lot of fun. Well, as you know, I was a born ham, and I went along with this to the extent that he was going to be a captain for the day, I was going to be a sailor for the day. So I'd pick a fairly burly leading seaman and put on his uniform, and I would be the bosun's mate for this captain of the day to do captain's rounds, and then have a lot of fun with it. Well, in Belfast, I can remember this so darn well. I got into the leading seaman's uniform, a leading seaman's sewell. I can still remember it. Now, he was a little burlier than I was, but the uniforms, those bell-bottom trousers and jumpers are so darn tight. You have to get into one, you've got to have one a little larger than you think you're going to need. And I got this young OD in and got them all dressed up in my uniform. I think by then I just maybe got an acting lieutenant commander's stripe. Being a young lieutenant with pretty low seniority, one of the ways they could reward you for sea service was to give you a little extra seniority, and they brought in the rank of acting lieutenant commander, and I think I had just made it. Maybe not, but might have still been a lieutenant. Anyway, this lad got all dolled up in my uniform, and then we went all around the ship, and we had a little glass here and there with each mess in turn, especially with the chiefs and the petty officers, and this young boy would tell off the chiefs and make them do a little extra cleaning and sweeping. It was all good fun. And then when it was all over, the young boy would come back to my cabin and give him a glass of beer and say, well, happy Christmas to you. Well, it so happened that members of the Admiral's staff had become good friends of mine, and they were having a little party ashore about in the middle of the afternoon. And these Christmas rounds aboard the Restigouche, you can imagine, we're away from home, or 150, 175 fellows, trying to have a good time. The Restigouche was a happy ship, a good ship. We had the sound reproduction system going, playing the gramophone records, singing carols, and Davy Bruce was there leading us and leading the choruses. We really had a roaring good away from home Christmas, as only the Navy can in circumstances like that. So here was I, still in my bell-bottom trousers, a leading seaman's uniform, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and we were invited to one of the Admiral's staff, the intelligence officer, by the name of Cochrane, I remember. And we went. I went to his house in my bell-bottom trousers. It's a bit of a shock, really, I suppose, at first. I mean, one could say you shouldn't have done that, but what the hell, it's Christmas Day and we're a long way from home. And I kind of fancied this bell-bottom trousers square rig that I was wearing. Well, we had a very good party there, and that lasted a few hours. And then I knew that all the ship's company who could be spared were going to be at what was called the Ulster Hall in Belfast for a big dance on that evening, early in the evening. Things were early because it was dark early, and you had your fun early and then went home early. So I let the cat out of the bag, I guess. I told some of the coxswain, some of the others aboard ship, that they were all going. I said, what are you chaps going to do tonight? They said, we'll all be at the Ulster Hall. I said, I'm going to drop into the Elster Hall myself, and I'll probably still be in my bell bottoms. So sure enough, in due course, about 8 o'clock in the evening, I went from this one party, off I went to the Elster Hall. And the Elster Hall perhaps had 1,000 people there dancing around with a beautiful orchestra, and with them were about 100 of the radiance from the rest of Gooch. Well, I recognized them all, and they recognized me, and it's pretty clever that they did, because I was not in my uniform, nor were they. All the ordinary seamen were dressed as chiefs. All the chiefs were dressed as ordinary naval seamen. And here we were all having this little dress-up game at the Elster Hall. Well, Elster Hall, there was a dance going on, and one after the other, the sailors had come up and introduced me to the girlfriends of the evening, and they'd say, "This is the captain." And the girls would say, "Oh, don't give me that. He's only a leading end." So I'd have a little dance with them. I must say, I got along all right in my own merits as a leading seaman. I didn't have to pull rank to have fun that night. It was quite an occasion. Well, late that night, quite late, we were having so much fun at the Elster Hall. It was such a real splurge for everybody. But we didn't go home till well after midnight, and I went home with some of the sailors. And I remember they were members of the Torpedoman's Mess. And when we got aboard about 2 o'clock in the morning, they were very respectful. They said, "Well, Skipper, we've had a very good time. It's very good of you to come with us. We appreciate it very much." And then they brought a pause and said, "Skipper, will you come down to the Torpedoman's Mess and have a little trot with us?" So here am I, the captain, improperly dressed as it were, saying, "Yes, I'll go down to the Torpedoman's Mess and have a trot." That's against the regulations. They had a little saved up for Christmas.
Breaking your own regulations.
Breaking my own laws. However, we go down, I say, "Sure, what the hell? After all, it is Christmas." Or was Christmas a few hours ago. Down we go to the Torpedoman's Mess, and sure enough, they get out a little Coke bottle somewhere, and it's got a little of the good old Black Demon rum, and we mix it up with some Coke, and we all have a nice little innocent drink. It was good fun. And just as that was about over, the leading hand of the mess said, "Skipper, would you like some bacon and eggs?" Half past 2 in the morning. I said, "I sure would. But where the hell are you going to get bacon and eggs at this time of the night aboard this ship?" He said, "Where else? The officer's galley." I said, "You sons of guns, I know it's locked and everything else is locked and all the storerooms are locked, but if you can go from here and go to the officer's galley and cook up some bacon and eggs, I'm sure as hell going to have them with you." 20 minutes later, down they came with great steaming plates of bacon and eggs and toast and coffee, and we had ourselves a feast. Such was life at Christmas Day, and that was good for all of us. Well, I must end this part. Having got fixed up there, we went back onto the ocean, and we did the convoys once again through the awful parts of January, February, March, April of 43, we are now in 43. And around... the end, around June 1943, or a little before that, it was indicated that I was going to leave the Restigouche, and I was going to get a new ship, a new fleet destroyer. So I think it was probably around April. I went back from across the Atlantic with a convoy. Before that, actually, we did a run out to Algiers. Another factor of this convoy, SC-107, why we had so many U-boats on our tail, this is, again, going back to November 42, was that the operation in North Africa had started. What was that? Operation Torch. And you may remember that this monumental expedition from the UK down the coast of, west coast of France and Portugal and southern Spain, through to Gibraltar, all got through, this huge armada of ships got through without being sighted by a single U-boat or a single German aircraft. It was a most wonderful good luck. And it is thought by Dr. Rover and others that indeed my convoy, SCA-107, was a honeypot that got the flies.
You had them all.
I had them all on convoy SCA-107. That's exactly what happened. So, that wasn't very nice. Something else I found out from Dr. Rover was that Admiral Dönitz, who was in charge of the U-boat warfare, had his headquarters in Paris. The Germans had occupied Paris, of course, and he had his headquarters there, directing the U-boat war in the North Atlantic from the German point of view. And he had sent this pack of 9 U-boats onto my convoy the time before, this ONS-137 that was coming from Britain, the one that got scattered, and I was very lucky to get through, he had 9 U-boats on that, and when he heard in Paris that that convoy had got through without a single ship being sunk, he really gave them a Royal Imperial blast. And he said, called them all kinds of...
dump cops.
Dump cops, that's right, whatever the equivalent is. That they were lazy, slack, had no dash and courage. They should have obliterated this convoy, and they let the whole thing through their grasp. He said, now there's another, having had the intelligence, of course, there's another one coming out, SC-107. I'm going to put twice the number of U-boats, and you better get every bloody U-boat in that pack, or don't come back to your home base and show your face. So really, SC-107 was also a convoy of retribution on the part of the Germans to try to obliterate the disgrace of having let convoy 137 through without any losses. So much for that. Well, I got back to Halifax probably in May 1943, this is, and this is just at the stage when the U-boat battle is getting under control with the brilliant work of Captain Walker and Lieutenant Commander Gretton and Lieutenant Commander McIntyre, and indeed the Canadian groups as well. And we did a quick run before doing that out to Algiers with the troop with a troop convoy. That was a pleasant little change. I was not senior officer of that group, but I went with a mixture of British and Canadian ships. We picked up these 6 or 8 ocean liners, as we used to do in Halifax in the early part of the war. We took them out of Southampton down the coast of Spain. It was lovely in February to have a nice warm weather that we'd never had on the North Atlantic. We knew that as soon as we got through the Straits of Gibraltar, we would be reported to the enemy, and we had to be on the qui vive after that. We were shadowed by Focke Wulf aircraft going down. We got through Gibraltar, and the first night we got through Gibraltar was a flat, calm night. The moon was shining. It was absolutely delightful. The convoy was belting along at about 22, maybe 19, 20 knots. And the rescue ship, I was just a private ship on that occasion. Well, it wasn't long before we got U-boat reports. And the senior officer dispatched me. There was one that came near the convoy, didn't sink anything. And I was sent to chase it. And I was told to stay with it until it could be no longer a threat to the convoy. So I went dashing off in the rescue. And I stayed with it for about a half an hour, making damn sure it was, once it was down, we couldn't actually pick it up. And then, having made sure it was no longer a threat to this troop convoy, I then turned around and I belted on to 30 knots to rejoin the convoy, and I knew it would take me an hour and a half to catch up. While I was steaming along, just about to go and get a little rest, all of a sudden, to my absolute horror, my heart stood still. There on the starboard side were 3 phosphorescent torpedo tracks coming right for the bridge of the rescue. And once again, that's split second judgment that you had. I had it all figured out, all the people who would be killed, what might happen to me, bend your knees, hard to starboard, do everything that you could. I began to think of where the torpedoes would hit and what the damage would be, how we'd get off the ship, how we'd get the Carly floats and the life and other things, what signals I'd make. But just in a split second, all that goes through your mind. And just as they were about to hit the ship, we were in the midst of a turn, a starboard turn. The 3 torpedo tracks, just as they got close to the ship, like all 3 came out of the water, did a nice little jump, turn 90 degrees to starboard. There were 3 dolphins.
Oh.
I'll never forget it. The signalman was Art Howard. He looked at me with a high falsetto voice and excitement in the moment. He says, "Captain, will you go down first, or shall I go to change our pants?" Oh, dear. Well, back we go to Halifax, and I give up my C4 group. Was taken over by, I think, a Royal Navy officer. Very nice little guy. I forget his name just for the moment. And I went off to Halifax, and this, to all intents and purposes, about April or early May, 43, was the end of my mid-Atlantic convoy work. I was appointed to a new ship, the destroyer that was building and wouldn't be ready for the Canadians to come for a few months. And I turned the ship over, I'm delighted to say, to my first lieutenant, who had already gone to a corvette temporarily, and just before I left Newfoundland to come down to Halifax, they were going to appoint somebody else, a ship's officer, another lieutenant commander was named, But Davy Bruce, who was still a lieutenant, we wanted Davy to be our captain. We thought he'd earned it. He was a captain of this corvette. And we set up a slogan, Bruce for the guts. Bruce for the guts. And everywhere we went, we go to Captain Davy. We said, look, sir, you've got to give a ship to Davy Bruce. He's been in it for several years. He knows it backwards. He's done a great job. And he's in the corvette now. You can get somebody else to command the corvette, but you want a destroyer skipper. Bruce for the guts. Do you know? We got Bruce for the guts, by golly.
Good.
And Davy Bruce took over the ship. And I had a week of parties in the Newfoundland before leaving, said goodbye to everybody about five times, had a fantastic series of farewells and parties, and then I flew to Halifax via Sydney. And what happens when I arrive in Sydney? An absolute wreck of a man, was looking forward to meeting my wife and family at home in Halifax. I get to Sydney, I find that an old friend of mine is the CO there, Shel Coleman, and that night, that I, just as I arrived, he was having a party. So, with lots of stamina, we joined that party too, and then the next day I was flown down to Halifax to the end of the seagoing of the Mid-Atlantic Convoy. At the end of all that time, I'd been over 2 years in escort commander, and 4 years of experience on the North Atlantic, and I decided that since I'd had that and had a little time toward the end before I left it, I would write a report. And I'd begun to compile this about a month before I left the North Atlantic. As things got a little quieter in April and I didn't have any losses, I had time on these trips to ponder and think, how are we doing? And I wrote a report, which I called Observations on the Operation and Administration of the Canadian Ships in the Mid-Atlantic ocean, mid-ocean convoy routes. And I was as totally subjective on this as I could be. I took every aspect of our operation and our administration, analyzed it, and very briefly and succinctly said, this it is what it is like at sea, and this is what I think should be done.
Excuse me, with respect, do you mean subjective or objective?
Objective, you're quite right. I always get mixed up in those things. Make that objectively.
It's
stuck to the point.
Yeah.
Good. I didn't pull any emotionalism on this, but I just took the facts as I saw them. What are our ships like? Well, the main difficulties were that you could not get modern equipment in the Canadian ships. Equipment that was made for the British ships was fitted to the British ships, and when they had some left over and we had time to go get it, we would get it. Our allocation came last. The Americans had some very good equipment. It went into the American ships first, and we would get it last. There was no method whereby Canadian escort ships would get equipment on a par. Although it was an Allied effort in the war, we could not get equipment on a par with the U.S. Navy and the British Navy. And we were always at the tail end of anything of that sort. Our operational schedules were such that although we got more and more ships and more crews and our Navy increased in size and size, we never got to the stage until after the May U-boat war was more or less in hand. In all those years through 41, 42, early 43, we never had enough ships in our escort groups. Always one destroyer and four or five corvettes. As our frigates came out, it got a little bit better, but we were always changing captains, changing senior officers, and that sort of thing. So we were at a disadvantage in equipment, and we were at a disadvantage in training. From the point of view of personnel, it was my belief then, and it is now, that the officers and men that we had in our Canadian services, Canadian Navy during the war, were the finest material, manpower material, in the Allied forces. We had the most physically fit, the best educated, the young men with the greatest potential in any of the forces. We had no difficulties with the language, caste system such as happens in the UK. A Canadian sailor, we had, as you know only too well, we had people with college educations who were able seamen and doing one hell of a good job because that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to get into the war. They didn't care whether they were officers or what. We had very, very fine people. course, included in our ship's company. We had lots of French-Canadian boys, particularly from Quebec and New Brunswick. And looking now at the difficulties that are happening in Canada over this language problem, there was none of this during the war whatsoever. The boys from Quebec, etc., they spoke with an accent that was amusing, and they were characters, but they were Canadians the same as we were, and doing a tremendous job. It was tough on them, I imagine, because it was up to them to learn the English language as we spoke it. And they didn't seem to have any trouble in that, and they were great guys and great characters. Another aspect of our officer class was that we had three different organizations. We had the Royal Canadian Navy, and I was RCN myself, and then we had the Royal Canadian Volunteer Reserve, the RCNVR, the Wavy Navy, and these were the boys from Civvy Street who came in for the war. And then we had the professional seamen officers from the merchant ships, and they were Royal Canadian Naval Reserve without the volunteer, and they were expert mariners and handlers of merchant ships. And there's been a lot of talk in a lot of books that the Royal Canadian Navy, to begin with, had a small officer corps. They were all what they were called flaming straight stripers, and you can interpret that any way you like, somewhat in a derogatory manner. I think the RCN straight stripers were considered to be a little snooty, that they had a feeling that an RCNVR officer didn't know anything about the sea and would be hard to make an officer out of them, that they thought the merchant navy officers lacked a lot of the gentlemanly qualities which a naval officer is supposed to have. But it was all really at our level at sea. That was a pack of nonsense. And I was a flaming straight striper. I was probably the only one. No, Davy Groos was also RCN aboard the Restigouche. We never, ever thought of that problem at any stage. We mixed up with the corvettes and the other ships where all the officers were volunteer reserve officers, and we were all fighting the same battle on the same basis. I can imagine perhaps at shore that this problem did raise its head from time to time, but certainly it never did in the seagoing fraternity, and that's a very good thing. Well, I'll just conclude this, if I may, on this report that I made. That's talking about the personnel. I had some comments to make on the morale of the Canadian personnel. We were at a great disadvantage. You take our convoy routine. We worked from, most of us in the mid-ocean, we worked from St. John's, Newfoundland to Londonderry. That trip would take 11, 13, 15, anything up to 21 days, depending on the weather. And the weather always seemed to get worse every year. And there we were pounding across that bloody ocean with the barometer always going down, the waves always getting higher, slogging our way, zigzagging, doing the best we could to protect convoys. The weather was normally a bigger enemy than the U-boat, and it was monotonous and boring as hell, and we had to be awfully clever on board our own ships. So, as I've told you, we were very lucky in the Restigouche. We had fun in spite of it all. But it was a boring routine. And where did we have our spare time? We had our spare time over in Londonderry. We'd come in and have about 4 or 5 days to get your reports in, and then you'd be given 4 or 5 days leave, and you come back and do 4 or 5 days exercises, and then you'd sail. Oh, but we'd be in 2 weeks in Londonderry. We'd come back across, slog our way across the ocean, get to St. John's, Newfoundland. There we'd be in 4 days. You'd get into port. You'd have this avalanche of correspondence to deal with, especially as a captain. You'd have your reports to make, a brief little bit of training. Only there 3 or 4 days, and then we're off to sea again. Our British colleagues who take their situation from Londonderry, they all had free passes on the railway 4 times a year to go home free of charge. They'd leave Londonderry, they'd be home with their families and their friends for a week, and while we were hanging around the pubs of Londonderry, you know, very nice, very lovely spot, but it was difficult. So we had a morale problem from that point of view, not a deeply serious one, but my recommendation was we should have good recreation facilities in Londonderry, and we should have good recreation facilities in St. John's, Newfoundland. Which that latter part was attended to later. But generally, we were at a disadvantage when it came to morale. There are many, many things in this report. Now, the interesting thing to me on this report, I went to a lot of trouble. The report was about 30 pages. And I say so myself. It was a reading it as I have in recent years. It was a pretty good effort.
You still have it?
I have a copy of it, yes. But I didn't think anything more of it, because When I was over in London as Agent General in 1977-78, I got a letter from a young scholar in Canada who said he was doing a PhD study on the Royal Canadian Navy in wartime, and one of the things he had come across was the Peers Report. And could I manage to have a discussion with him on it sometime? And I thought of this, here we are 25, 30 years later. I said, what the hell is the Peers Report? And then I suddenly, oh gosh, that's that report that I made in June 1943. And the fact of the matter was that having put in that report and worked, sweated blood over it, and did have some awfully good recommendations, if I say so myself, I went back to sea, back in the convoy doing this. I never heard another thing about it. Nobody wrote from the shore to say, we acknowledge receipt of your report. It went to the senior officer in Newfoundland, and that's the last I ever heard of it. So when I talked to this young scholar, I said, I presume you mean this report that I did in 1943. He said, yeah, that's the one, and all the other stuff, the volumes that went with it. I said, well, I don't know anything about the volumes that went with it. I just have no idea. Never heard anything, never saw anything. And to my amazement, he said, you don't have that? He said, I'll get it and send it to you. So eventually, a few months later, I got about 40 pages of comments from Ottawa. They'd taken everything I'd said, and they'd analyze it and say, this is good, that's a maybe, that's a no. And they'd done a tremendous amount of work. The fellas at sea, you never hear of those things. You did what you could. You did it for why. You never do anything in this world for somebody to say thank you. But it did seem to me odd that this young university scholar should be the one to bring it to my attention that somebody had paid some report to us. Quite an interesting report that was made. So there, that sees me the end of June 1943, back in Halifax, reunited with my family for the first time in a long, long while. My old love of home port of Halifax, back with my wife and daughter, and a little visit down to Chester where we had a family summer home. And
where we're sitting today, by the way.
Where we're sitting today.